Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, October 11th, 2018. Girls in South Sudan call on their country's leaders to respect their dignity and their right to an education.
Boys are the ones participating in the school. If the results are out, all the people who are in top 10 are boys, which is not good.
And one analyst calls Ambassador Haley an outspoken supporter of the people of South Sudan and says she will be missed.
The White House has very few women in its cabinet, and that for one of the women to be leaving so suddenly, it seems a bit of a shock to many.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. As the world today marks the International Day of the Girl, in South Sudan, girls are calling on their government to do more to help them receive a proper education. Low teacher salaries and too many unqualified teachers are just some of the many problems girls want addressed by lawmakers. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
For example, if a family is having 3 boys and 2 boys, the family will...
That is 16-year-old Marcelina, a primary 7 pupil of Juba Model Primary School, during a debate with the other pupils at Juba 1 Girls Primary School today over whether or not girls can lead and contribute to nation building. Marcelina says the government should improve conditions at schools and parents should allow girls time to do homework.
Teachers are not paid salaries, so they have to be paid salaries so that we shall have enough teachers, enough female teachers in our school. And also the challenges facing girls in the school, that they are not concentrating to what the teacher is saying. For instance, in our school, boys are the ones participating in the school. If the results are out, all the people who are in top 10 are boys, which is not good. So I think maybe they are having a lot of work at home, so which is not good.
The NGO Plan International organized the debate on International Day of the Girl and has launched a 5-year campaign to empower South Sudanese girls. Plan International's program director in South Sudan, Abadi Amdoum, says the campaign is all about improving access to education for girls and reducing gender-based violence, or GBV.
We will work very aggressively on education, especially on quality education for girls, mainly for girls, because we have been, left behind. So we have also very serious work on health, which mainly includes sexual reproductive health rights. We have also on livelihoods, on child protection, protecting our girls from child marriage, from abuse, from neglect, from sexual, from GBV.
14-year primary 8 pupil Males, who attends Juba Model Primary School, was named the symbolic chief guest at today's launch of the campaign. Males stood in as the director general at the Jubek State Ministry of Education, a move intended to make her feel the power of making major decisions that affect students, teachers, and schools across the country. Males says low teacher salaries across the board and incompetent teachers negatively impacts children's ability to get an education, and called on the government to train more teachers.
I would like to suggest that there should be a teacher lesson attendance, so that if he finishes or she finishes teaching, he or she must sign in that book. And the inspectors, they should inspect this book every month.
According to the South Sudan Ministry of General Education, at least 70% of South Sudan's population is illiterate. In a report released earlier this year by Plan International, William Atter, advisor at the South Sudan Ministry of Education, said nearly 2 million South Sudanese children, the vast majority of whom are girls, are not enrolled in school. The report said the nearly 5-year conflict affects girls far more than boys, and that adolescent girls were often forced into early marriage or prostitution instead of attending school. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Last week was International Teachers' Day, which highlights the contribution of teachers worldwide, but it also shines a spotlight on the persistent challenges facing teachers. Teachers receive minimal pay and face enormous challenges at refugee camps in northern Uganda, but remain united on one thing, their determination to continue teaching hundreds of South Sudanese children. Megumi Davis-Rakawinji recently visited a camp in northern Uganda and has this report from Kampala.
How do we pronounce this word?
It is box, not a buck.
Andrew gave me his...
Teacher Ben Arika conducts an English lesson at St. Luke's Primary School in the Nyumanzi refugee settlement of northern Uganda's Adjumani district. About 100 children are crowded into a tiny classroom. Many of them are Sudanese refugees. Arika says it is challenging to teach a group of children who have been traumatized by events they have witnessed.
We have few textbooks for teaching these children. So it is really a challenge for us. Secondly, these children themselves, at times they turn up in the school, it's not okay. At times you will teach very few people in the class, at times there will be very many. So it is really difficult to determine the number of children in the class.
15-year-old people, Majongo Magai says he wants to become a teacher when he grows up.
These teachers, they are teaching us very well. Those are, we pass very well. In this last term, I got segregated first grade. So that these teachers, they are teaching us very well. I learn now, I know how to write and I know how to speak in English.
Arika says, despite receiving minimal pay, he's satisfied in the knowledge that he's able to improve the lives of these children.
I've realized that there are very many of them at first who could not do anything because they are coming here in the school. Others could not do anything total, but this time, there are many who can read and write. Even in my class, others could not read completely. So we really struggled and we have brought them better.
And you feel proud of that?
Yeah, I'm very proud because it is an achievement as a teacher if you really teach them well.
Primary school teachers in Uganda are paid between 200 to 300,000 Uganda shillings per month or between $50 to $80. Lillian Anguchia, who teaches mathematics in primary 2 at St. Luke's Primary School in Nyumanzi refugee camp, says children lack even the basic necessities of life at the school.
We don't have water. At break time, when these pupils come for porridge, they don't have water for washing their plates. And the classrooms are not enough. In a class, there are too many, so the space is not enough.
According to UNESCO, there is still a vast shortage of teachers, not only in refugee camps hosting South Sudanese refugees, but across the globe. UNESCO says some 264 million children do not attend school worldwide. To achieve the 2030 educational goal of universal primary and secondary education for all, UNESCO recommends at least 69 million new teachers be recruited globally. South Sudanese refugee Bulgarang Gabriel is the deputy head teacher who teaches mathematics at the St. Luke's Primary School. He believes teachers' efforts will yield long-term benefits for students and the entire country.
Those who are educated, they don't want fighting. They want only peace. Knife is very important when you know that, when you learn and you are educated, you find that knife is very important. But when you are framed, you don't know, you just fight. But now we are going to change our country when we get education here in Uganda.
The theme for this year's World Teachers' Day is the right to education means the right to a qualified teacher. A reminder that education cannot be achieved without trained and qualified teachers. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
When she announced her resignation on Tuesday, President Donald Trump's outgoing ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, ticked off a list of her accomplishments, one of which was aimed at stopping the nearly five-year conflict in South Sudan. The UN Security Council approved an arms embargo on South Sudan in July, which was pushed through largely by Haley, who visited the country in 2017 and saw the devastation caused by the civil war with her own eyes. Amira Woods, an advocate with the group Africa Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity, says Haley will leave a big void in the Trump cabinet when she leaves at the end of the year.
I think there is a sense that the White House has very few women in its cabinet, and that for one of the women to be leaving so suddenly seems a bit of a shock to many. I think the concern is that you still have an administration that on foreign policy is divided and not speaking of one voice or one doctrine. And I think what we see is a National Security Council under John Bolton that is you know, almost antagonistic to multilateralism, to internationalism. And you have seen through the U.S. mission at the U.N., a much different approach to the United Nations and to global engagement. And so I think there's still a lot that when the, you know, when the documents are declassified, I would say that we will learn more in future times. The historians will be able to tell us about what's actually going on behind the scenes.
Take a look back at her 2 years. What do you think? Was she forceful? Did she do a great job? Was she just moderately successful? Or what do you think?
I think Nikki Haley was in a very tough position with this administration to try to embrace a role at the UN. I think, it, you know, from the start, you've had those in this administration that do not want a United Nations, that so do not see a value for global cooperation, right? So when you have the U.S. pulling out of key international treaties, whether it's the Paris Treaty on Climate or, you know, or moving in a more unilateral way when it comes to Iran, I mean, I think you see many areas in which the international work of a body like the U.N. is actually being undermined by the administration. And so I think she was in a very difficult position. I think one of the areas where she provided clear leadership was on Myanmar. And I think that there, you know, with the anniversary of the atrocities in Myanmar, I think, you know, she really laid out the concerns around accountability.
Along those same lines, a lot of people are saying, you know, she did the same thing regarding South Sudan and got that South Sudan arms embargo pushed through with the Security Council. What's your reaction to that?
Right. I think there were many areas in which it seemed like the State Department was being hesitant or you know, less bold and taking less of a leadership role than many would have liked. And I think, you know, South Sudan and the arms embargo is one of those examples where, you know, leadership was needed. And I think she used the sort of bully pulpit of the UN effectively in those areas. And I think that is of value to the work of the international community.
That is Amira Woods, an advocate with the group Africa Rising for Justice, Peace, and Dignity. She was speaking with me here in Washington yesterday. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Another deadly roadside attack in Jonglei State. Find out where when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
would it matter to you if your presidential candidate were a woman?
No, it wouldn't at all. I think man-woman, for me, it's about someone who gets the job done and someone who understands that leadership is about service and not using power for selfish reasons.
It does not matter. As long as she's productive, that's it.
I would be very happy if my presidential candidate was a woman, because I see that women are equal to men. We are there to support. And a lot of things that women have done, I think men have perceived to do it, but women do it better.
For me, it does not matter whether it is a man or a woman. Leadership is not by sex. Rather, ability.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Jonglei State officials say two people are dead and three others injured after unidentified gunmen opened fire on a commuter taxi traveling from Bor to Juba. As Dengai Deng reports for VOA from Bor, several other people are still missing after the attack.
28-year-old Gang Agwok was shot in his right arm during today's attack. He says two men sitting next to him were shot and killed by three gunmen wearing police uniforms in Malinthur, about 20 kilometers from Bor town.
The attackers come from the east, and of course we are not aware of those people. They start shooting us. We even wonder Then we tell the driver to continue driving. Then after that, the car just stopped. Then we start coming out. At that moment, two people were shot dead. And so far, three people were injured.
Agwok and the other three commuters injured in the attack are being treated at the Vaud Civil Hospital. Jonglei State Deputy Governor Agot Alier says the vehicle that was attacked was carrying 10 passengers.
And that is the incident that has happened in the area called Melinthor, just south of border, South County, that is in our border with Tarkaka State, where this morning a vehicle, a car that left from Bor, was attacked by some bandits. Presumably from Buma State, and which has resulted into the death of two people.
Alier says he has dispatched police who are trying to track down the killers as well as the missing passengers.
We have already sent down a police force to the area to go and ascertain the situation, but the initial report we have now that we have two people dead in that attack.
Alier says deadly violence along Juba Bor Road and other areas of Jonglei has got to stop.
It becomes a disappointment when we see a life is lost again in the hand of this type of criminals who are not trying to heed to the calls by our president. It's that it is now time for us to bring an end to banditry and see into that. Peace prevail among our communities. Avoid child abduction, avoid cattle raiding, and even ambushing civilian cars.
Alier is calling on South Sudanese communities to adhere to the recently signed revitalized peace agreement and to respect the lives and dignity of other human beings. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Hundreds of activists and refugees protested today on the streets of Nairobi, demanding that the Kenyan government take action against South Sudanese officials sanctioned by the UN. This comes on the heels of a documentary released on YouTube by Kenya investigative journalist John Allen Namu, exposing corruption by top South Sudanese officials and some Kenyan officials. Winnie Serino has the story for VOA from Juba.
The documentary, The Profiteers, went viral on social media. It shows the palatial homes of President Salva Kiir in Ethiopia, former South Sudan Army Chief Paul Malong in Kenya, and former South Sudan Finance Minister Stephen Diu Dao in Kampala. It also features interviews with the SPLA-IO Governor-Designate for Yei River State, Major General Frank Matata, and SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lampo Gabriel. SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lampo Gabriel, who was interviewed in the documentary, accuses Namu of hiding behind journalism to achieve personal gains and elevate his career by damaging other people's reputations.
That documentary lacks a lot of truth. I met Alan, I can't lie to everyone about it. What he put out or what he published out is just the part that he feels if he likes to use them as some of the image or to spoil our name and reputation. But the whole truth about the whole thing, he left it out of the documentary. And I'm really challenging Alan to be able to play the whole documentary instead of choosing what he thinks is good and leaving out what he thinks is not good. But our role as SPLA-IO is to make sure that no one is cheated. The businessman or the community is not cheated by either party.
Gabriel says he is offended by the documentary and is threatening to sue Namu over assertions that Gabriel illegally exported South Sudanese teak.
As an individual, I'm definitely glad to take this case to the court of law, because if the case to take it to the court of law, I'm taking it to the court of law. This is not only an insult to me as an individual, it is also the defamatory kind of accusation or blasphemy, which I don't think I will tolerate. Alan knows the real truth of our discussion. It's about what he put up. He knows it, and I'm going to respond to him. So if he is serious and he wants this thing to be done, I want him to take this case to court. So I'm not worried of anything because I've never taken anybody's money. I've never created any business in terms of that regarding cheating.
A Yei-based civil society activist who prefers to be identified only as Benson for fear of reprisals says teak exploitation in former Century Kotera State has increased after the fresh wave of fighting in 2016. He says there are high-quality teak trees in areas like Loka, Kegulu, Dapi and Umbasi.
What happened is that the witnesses have been seeing that these parties to conflict, when people flooded to the neighboring countries for refuge, they said they went in two ways. They used the arms, and then they also went with the machines to cut trees and transport them to where they can sell it.
Benson says, unlike in the past, local community leaders no longer monitor logging activities in their areas. He is urging South Sudan's leaders to use natural resources for the benefit of local communities.
They always believe that this is not only for individuals, but it is for the community. So if someone wants to come and do investment in this, it must be made very clear on the terms must be put down. How is this community going to benefit? So at the moment, we're really engaging that let this be implemented. And then two, we're also looking into that, let this tick cutting stop.
South Sudan in Focus reached out several times to the government for comment. Deputy Information Minister Lily Albina Cole declined the offer. Government spokesman Michael Makwe is out of his office and unreachable by phone. Journalist John Allen Namu was contacted but did not answer repeated calls. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
The weekend takeover of the National Security Headquarters in Juba by prisoners housed there has opened up more questions about political prisoners in South Sudanese jails. Director of the Sud Institute, Jock Madut Jock, who was once arrested in the capital himself, says many political prisoners remain behind bars.
Yes, I know Carabino Wall, I know Peter Biara Jack, I know a couple of other people. And many of them are in detention for months. Some of them, in fact, most of them, with no charges whatsoever. And so when people are detained for so long without due process of the law, that is a classic definition of political detainees or detainees of conscience, prisoners of conscience, meaning they are being detained either for their ideas that they have expressed publicly or for suspicion of engaging in some kind of political act or espionage or conspiracy or to overthrow the government. All of those things are definitions of a political detainee. So when the spokesperson of the presidency spoke of having no political detainees, that is a total lie.
Why would the presidential spokesman tell lies?
Well, I mean, that is really typical of the kind of mediocrity that defines the way the government of South Sudan is being run. When some of us who are critical of the way the country is run, in hope that our criticism can be taken up to improve things. On the contrary, what happens, this is defensive attitude, which does not help anyone, doesn't help them, doesn't help the citizen, doesn't help the nation. So we are at loss for what to say when people who should know better go in public and make misrepresentation of the situation that every citizen knows.
That's Jock Madut Jock, director and co-founder of the Juba-based Sud Institute, speaking from London on Monday. In the second part of the interview, Jock talks in more detail about the various detention centers in Juba with my colleague, John Danza. Many Sudanese are complaining after the government's sharp devaluation of the pound on Sunday, cutting its official value almost in half as an economic crisis continues to grip the country. The end of long-standing U.S. economic sanctions in 2017 has not produced a hoped-for economic revival in Sudan, and it remains on the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. Edward Uranian has more for VOA from Cairo.
Housewives shop at a vegetable market in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, following the official government devaluation of the Sudanese pound Sunday from 28 to 47.5 to the dollar. Prices of staples are going up, and inflation has hit nearly 70% since the start of the year. One consumer in Khartoum tells Al Hurra TV that rising prices are scaring everyone. He says prices are very, very high for everything, and it is hard to afford food, drink, and medical care. A middle-aged worker told Al Hurra money is tight, and his salary does not cover half of his monthly expenses. Sudan's recently appointed Prime Minister Mu'taz Musa told Parliament Monday the government will allow the Sudanese pound to float freely. He says it is not entirely clear what allowing the Sudanese pound to trade freely against the U.S. dollar will do to the value of the pound. Sudanese economist Issam Ismail told Al Hurra TV it will encourage badly needed outside investment by making the exchange rate clear to everyone. He says the Sudanese Central Bank and commercial banks will publicize rates in hard currency for investors and exporters to go by, so they will receive their money at a known value. The IMF has long urged the Sudanese government to have a unified exchange rate for its currency, but many observers think the economy is troubled by shortage of foreign currency. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA that the Sudanese economy is suffering from the side effects of the withdrawal of its army from Yemen and the loss of hard currency it was receiving in exchange for its participation in the Saudi-led coalition. Sudan, he says, has been dependent on money coming from the Gulf in return for sending troops to fight in Yemen. When Sudan was forced to withdraw its troops earlier this year due to heavy casualties, Sadiq notes Khartoum lost a lot of money from the Gulf states, so the economy began to have serious problems. Today, the Sudanese economy does not have big international support, he points out, so nobody is saving them, and they are in free fall. Many Sudanese economists were optimistic the economy would improve after the United States ended 20-year-old economic sanctions on Khartoum a year ago, but the move did little to spur outside investment or increase trade with the West. Some observers think investors will avoid the country until Sudan is removed from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Normalization of ties with the United States are also dependent on Khartoum easing religious discrimination. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Nambi by Saudi Soul. We've been listening to Saudi Soul with the song Nambi. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and we're glad you could join us today. You can check us out on our Twitter handle. It's at VOA South Sudan. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Oh, 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 oh. Hey.